WATD-FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
This is a WATD political forum on 95.9 WATD, online at 95.9WATD.com. Now, live from Studio B, here's your moderator, WATD's Christine James.
Good evening and welcome to a WATD political forum. I'm your moderator, Charles Mathewson, filling in for the venerable Christine James. Joined by Monday Night Talk host Kevin Tachi, along with reporter Lenny Rowe asking questions. This election race is for state representative for the 6th Plymouth District. Incumbent Democrat Josh Cutler and challenger Republican Ken Sweezy, both on the ballot in the general election next week. Timing is Lenny Rowe. Lenny, hold those up for our listeners. He's holding up construction paper. Green means go. Yellow means we're in Massachusetts. Go like hell, because next comes red. You have to stop at the red. I'll give you 5 seconds. And then the Tony O'Brien Memorial Bell. And after that, our engineer will cut off the mic. You ready, Larry?
I'm ready.
Okay. Our format is simple. We've asked the candidates to have two statements prepared for an opening and closing. No longer than 2 minutes for an open, no longer than 1 minute for a close, please. And because the closing is the end, it's non-rebuttable, please no personal attacks in the closing statement. Then we have a round of questions for the reporters and a lightning round where the answers are either yes or no, or two sentences tops. Also, please try to keep your answers to around a minute. If you constantly go over, ramble, or start to repeat yourself, you get the bell. We chose opening and closing statements, or the order of opening and closing statements out of the official WATD stand-in koozie, which I'm holding up for our listeners. Opening is Ken Sweezy, closing is Josh Cutler. Ken.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody here at WATD. Of course, thank you, Representative Cutler, for joining me tonight as well. For those that don't know me, my name is Ken Sweezy. I am your Republican candidate for state representative in the 6th Plymouth District, which I hope we will list the towns here shortly. So a little bit about me. I live and was raised in Hanson, still live there now. I was fortunate to grow up in the district. It is a great place to grow up and continue to raise a family. My family owns a small business, Sweezy Fence, in the adjacent town of Whitman. So I had the opportunity of, you know, growing up, you know, learning the value of a dollar and a hard day's work, a business that's been running for over 50 years, a legacy that I'm very proud to be a part of. I went off to school and got my degree in forensic science, which was a springboard into my career in law enforcement. I was very fortunate to serve alongside so many brave men and women in a large metro area. I served with the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department as a fingerprint expert for 4 years. Once COVID started, I joined the private sector here in Massachusetts about 2 years ago, and have been able to begin to volunteer and get involved in a lot of other ways as well. I serve on economic development and capital improvements for the town of Hanson. I look forward to the discussion ahead, and I think that you will see, you know, the differences in policy, good faith discussion that we will have, and I look forward to kind of showing you everything that my campaign is about.
Thank you. Josh Cutler.
Great. Thank you, Charles. Good evening, everybody. Thank you, Ken, for my opponent, for your participation. So I'm Josh Cutler. I'm the current state representative for the 6th Plymouth District, which I'll just list off the towns. It's Duxbury, Halifax Precinct 2, Hanson Precincts 2 and 3, Marshfield's Precinct 2A and 4, and Pembroke's Precincts 1, 2, 3A, 4, and 5. So briefly, my background. So I'm originally from the town of Duxbury. I ran a small family business for about 10 years, served in local government. I was on my planning board, also served on the Board of Selectmen and on the Alternative Energy Committee for a number of years. I have a law degree from Suffolk University and master's degree from UMass Dartmouth. I'm active with the Hanson Kiwanis Foundation and the Duxbury Free Library, Inc. Board. Just my personal life, I enjoy photography and history. I like to think of myself as an amateur historian, and I've written a couple of local books about local history. So professionally, I'm in my fifth term in the House of Representatives, currently the chairman of the Joint Committee on Labor and Workforce Development. I'm also the co-chair of the Future of Work Commission and the Coastal Caucus, and also this term co-founded the Blockchain Technology Caucus. I really enjoy my job. I love my job serving the residents of our district. I think we've managed to get a lot done working together. I bring a sort of, you know, roll-up-your-sleeves, problem-solving approach to this job, and I think it's been successful. If you look at the results and what we've been able to accomplish, both legislatively and in terms of bringing money back to the district. So I think, you know, Massachusetts has a lot to be proud of. We lead the nation in a lot of areas, education, healthcare, renewable energy. I think we made some important steps forward this term in a number of areas, particularly in terms of workforce development and economic development. I look forward to talking a little bit further about these issues and look forward to a good discussion. Thank you very much.
Hey, let's start questions with Kevin Tarchi.
Thank you, Mr. Matheson. It bodes worth noting also media partner, Whitman Hanson Community Access, as part of this process. So I want to thank everybody for being willing to be on camera this evening.
Thank you for that.
You got that. Let's talk about my favorite topic in Charles, water. This has become a major issue, whether it's a lack of quantity and quality, with changing climate, reoccurring droughts, reduced supplies, not to mention growing concerns over PFAS in drinking water, which has become a real expensive problem. Has the water issue impacted this district, and what do you think your role is in this matter? We'll go with Mr. Cutler.
Okay, great. Well, how much time do I have? Thank you for a great... Oh, boy. Thank you for a great question, Kevin. Hopefully we can come back to some of these issues because they deserve a little bit more time. I think there's a lot of different issues, facets of the water issue. We could talk about the whole situation with Silver Lake and Brockton Water. We could talk about Holtec and the water issues with the nuclear power plant. We could talk about water infrastructure. I think they're all really important. And there's been a lot of progress that has been made. I guess I'll just start with, you know, talking about sort of at the highest level. You know, water infrastructure and water usage are kind of the two key pillars of this topic. And I think we've made some important progress in recent terms addressing both of those issues. I was proud to be the lead sponsor of the Energy Save Act, which is a way to expand the use of water sense products here in Massachusetts to make to boost our water efficiency. Obviously, the cheapest form of water and energy is what we don't use in the first place. I'm already getting the yellow here before I've even gone into my first topic. But obviously, there's a lot of important topics here in terms of water. I hope we can talk a little bit more about this. I think, you know, we've done a lot of good progress this term, and I'm getting the red, so I'll stop.
Ken.
Certainly a loaded issue as well. Yeah, so many things. The biggest thing about the infrastructure piece is the sense of urgency. These are things that we can't wait for anymore. We really, really need to get in there. We need to talk to our towns and local communities. We need to find out what they need, and we need to get it to them now. It just can't take any longer. We just can't wait. You know, people getting brown water, water that's contaminated, that would be contaminated with PFAS. As you alluded to, Kevin, that's something the town of Duxbury actually closed a well, and we can't rely on federal funds coming into the state to supply these things. We need to, I believe, automate. The state regulates how many parts per million you can have of these chemicals in your drinking water before it's closed down. If we're going to have that regulation, we can't have anything unfunded. We need to make sure that the state is there to support the towns and the infrastructure. So that's sort of what my pledge is there, to make sure that we make sure the water is drinkable, the water is safe for use in any capacity. We make sure we automate those funds coming to our communities to make sure that we don't have to rely on budgeting process and federal funds and things of that nature. So
I can follow up with the elephant in the room, and that is the city of Brockton. And I know that Pembroke is one of those communities within the Silver Lake District. What's your thought in regards to what's going on with Silver Lake, Brockton's use of it, and how it affects a community like Pembroke and Hanson? Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. That is a key part of this puzzle. And I think there's been a lot of progress made in terms of the Central Plymouth County Water District, which is the governing body that now oversees the towns in the Central Plymouth County Water District, including Pembroke and Hanson, which I'm proud to represent. And I think just taking a step backwards in time, just because I think it's important to have a little bit of history, before, as listeners of WATD know, because you guys have covered this so well over the years, this is an issue that goes back to two centuries ago, to the 19th century. So it's not a new development. The most recent legislation was in the 60s on this. And so, you know, there's a lot of issues with the way our water is managed vis-a-vis the city of Brockton. One of the things we did, and I'll credit my former colleague, Representative Tom Qualter, who has really did a lot of great work on this issue, is we worked to revitalize the Central Plymouth County Water District, which is the authority that was initially created back in the 60s to help manage and govern some of these water management issues, and it had sort of fallen dormant for a number of years. And so we worked to revitalize that commission. It's now up and running. It now has a budget. We annually find money for that budget. I'm getting the red again, so hopefully we can come back to this.
Okay.
Pace of play, serious issue here at WATD. Love it. As far as the issue with Brockton and the Silver Lake towns, you know, everyone wants everyone to have water, right? Brockton needs some water as well. There's no problem with that. I believe there's been talks with, I believe it is the MWRA, to potentially start getting some water down from the Quabbin Reservoir as well in other parts of the state. The issue with Brockton taking water that's not being paid for is a big issue, and you see the environmental concerns as well, not only about, you know, droughts that can't be controlled, and that needs to be able to be a stopgap for the communities that the resources are actually in. Pembroke needs to be able to be tied in to their water, surface water sources if they need them. You know, they have plenty of groundwater sources, but a year like this with the drought and they run out, that's just inexcusable in Massachusetts in 2022. We need to do better. Again, everything around water is with a growing sense of urgency, and I'm always going to be an advocate to make sure that we bring all the stakeholders to the table. So you have people on these lakes that have negative consequences as well from the water being reversed and all that for the treatment facilities over there. So we just need to make sure that we're doing the best we can with all the stakeholders together.
All right. Lenny Rowe.
Thank you, Charlie. Charles. Through the Mass School Building Authority, towns can be reimbursed for school projects. So should there be a similar program for public safety buildings, especially where the town of Pembroke is considering a public safety facility? We'll start with Ken.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a big issue, right? When we talk about public safety, you know, especially with some of the regulations that have come in the past 2 years, and I know, and I'll get to the infrastructure question in particular, but with reform, you know, we need to assist these towns in payment for everything, whether it's training, whether it's facilities, equipment, to make sure that they're kept safe. And some of the towns in our district do have not updated facilities, you know, aging infrastructure that needs to be helped. With a $6 billion surplus, frankly, I think there's a lot of things that the state can be helping the towns in. The towns are not in a position typically where they're able to pick up these one-time costs when they are trying to pay for, you know, schooling and just salaries on police, fire, everything like that that they're already paying for. So, yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, the state needs to be able to step in if we're going to say that, you know, in good faith, we care about our law enforcement. And if infrastructure is a problem on the public safety side, that's 100% something that we can do, particularly with the large, you know, the large surplus that we have right now.
Thank you, Josh.
Yeah, no, I agree. In fact, just this weekend, I was at the Pembroke Fire Station open house and talking to our fire chief and police chief about this very issue. As you mentioned, the town of Pembroke is currently pursuing a public safety building, a combination public safety building. And in fact, I was successful in getting nearly $250,000 to the town of Pembroke to help with the design and engineering of that combination Pembroke public safety building. So, you know, that is something that I think is a dire need for the town. Obviously, we had also a big project to get a community center, which I was delighted to see finally got sort of ultimate approval just recently. So that's now going to move forward. And the next big project on the blocks is going to be, you know, certainly going to be the public safety building. And I'm certainly, you know, all on board for that. I think it's very much needed. I've already, as I said, gotten some funds for the state, and I'll continue to do that. We've also, in the budget last session, I got a smaller amount of money, $40,000 for the Pembroke Police Department to upgrade that security cameras in its booking room and also to get new radios. I've always, you know, looking to find new ways that I can get money for the, you know, cities and towns that I represent. We got a new $40,000 for a new, I'm getting the red again, for another new fireboat at the Duxbury Police Department, Fire Department.
Josh, I started covering the Pembroke Community Center the need to replace it 30 years ago. And, why did I say that? Now I feel old. Okay, let's talk about licenses. Ken, you are opposed to the law that allows undocumented people to get a license. Why?
Correct. So there's a couple aspects to this, right? One, I agree wholeheartedly with the governor on this. Governor Baker has said in no uncertain terms that he is genuinely concerned about the RMV's ability to essentially police this matter. It's just not the right department. I think the bill, went through a little too quickly and a little bit too much earnest to, whatever reason it may have. I'm opposed. I agree with the governor. I don't think it's the right time. It's not the right department to be handling this. The concerns we see in other states where this is being enacted, for example, I believe Colorado had 30,000 ballot applications sent out to undocumented immigrants in the state who got driver's licenses legally. It's just creating opportunities for issues that we don't need right now. Everyone cares about the sanctity of the vote. We just want to make sure. Also, it's creating a magnet to draw people into Massachusetts that are already in violation of our immigration laws, which in general, everyone, I'm all for everyone trying to make a better life for themselves, but plenty of people have done it legally, and we need to encourage that.
In the interest of facts, the 30,000 in Colorado went to, no one registered to vote as a result of an errant mailing. Josh, what do you feel about licenses?
I think we have a good faith disagreement here. I do support question four. I think it's a matter of public safety. The vast majority of law enforcement leaders in the Commonwealth are supporting question four, and that was really what convinced me. And I think it's important to note that we do already allow individuals who are not do not have the right to vote, but still have the ability to apply for a driver's license and pay the fee, take the driver's test just like everyone else. People who are green card holders, DACA recipients, teenagers, those are all individuals who can apply for a driver's license today but are not legally eligible to vote. So we've figured out a way to handle that. The RMV already does that. 17 other states already do this. So we're not, this isn't a brand, 16 in D.C. So I'm sorry to, assuming D.C. state, which is my error. But, I think this isn't brand new to Massachusetts. We've done this. Other states have done this. So I think it's a reasonable step to take. We know there are people living in our community right now who are undocumented. And I think we're all better off if they have driver's licenses and are tested and insured and when they're driving.
Okay.
Sorry, am I able to rebut that quickly?
After the break. Okay. Oh, the break? Yes, we're about to take a break. You're listening to a political forum on WATD.
How many breaks are there? That does seem right, yeah.
Oh, I was looking at the seconds instead of the minutes. Yes, rebut.
Now?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I thought we were...
So just a couple things on that. The law enforcement support that my opponent is referring to is by the major chiefs of police, which none of our five towns are a part of. The officers and the chiefs in this district do not want this law to stand. They do not want undocumented immigrants driving around. The second point... With that other point was getting a driver's license and getting tested does not lead to people being insured. Being insured has to do with registering your car, and that's an unfortunate talking point that is being promulgated out there that's trying to put people at ease, and that's not quite true. Just because someone has a license does not mean they register a vehicle or get insurance. So that is not an A to B transaction. That's always going to occur.
Given that we're not taking a break, Josh, do you have a rebuttal to the rebuttal?
You threw us off with the break, Charles. All right. I think, number one, on the first point, I'm looking just at a list of law enforcement support for this. The District Attorneys Association and the County Sheriff's Association of Massachusetts have both supported this. Obviously we can't see it on radio, but there's a list of, more than three dozen police chiefs and commissioners that are all supporting this, including some who are not members of the Mass Major Chiefs Association, including our top law enforcement officer, who is Maura Healy. So I think, it's a matter of public safety. I think the voting issue is a red herring, and it really is about public safety, and that's what it comes down to at the end of the day for me.
Do you think any people who are not naturalized citizens are driving currently, Ken?
Do I think they're driving without a license?
Yeah.
I mean, there's all sorts of people that drive without licenses. So.
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Kevin Tocci.
Yes, Charles. So, COVID has created a serious issues, post-pandemic issues, especially for local businesses that are seeking qualified employees. Remember years ago, the problem was there weren't enough jobs. Well, that's not the problem these days. The problem these days is finding enough folks who want to come to work. And it depends on your particular industry. What has the state been doing to not only study the situation, but fortify the labor workforce situation? We'll start with Mrs. Sweezy.
Sure. I mean, as the one not currently serving, I can't say everything that the state's doing to study. I would hope that in those studies, the state is assuming some responsibility from all of the causes that government-imposed lockdowns during the pandemic is causing this issue. You know, just if for the sake of doing the history part, it wasn't the virus that closed businesses. The government did that. You know, didn't close schools wasn't the virus's fault. The government did that. So I hope any study is really looking long and hard at the repercussions of future government action to tamp down economic activity and hurt our small businesses. But as far as what we need to do, it's something that's so connected, right? This is an economic issue that goes all across our district. We need to make sure that you're able to live here and work in this district, right? If we're looking for qualified employees, we need to make sure they're encouraged, they're actually incentivized to go to school and get a good degree that has applicable skills, and you're able to afford to live in this district, to live and work here. So there's big lessons to be learned from what happened and certain steps that we definitely need to take going forward.
Same question, Kevin. The question is that... COVID created some issues, especially when it came to employment. Now we got businesses that are looking for employees. And what has the state been doing to not only study this issue, but at least
find some kind of
long-term solution?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for the great question. And we're doing a lot more than just studying. And I'm very fortunate to be in the position I'm in, where I'm chair of the Labor and Workforce Development Committee. So this is something I've spent the last 2 years working quite a bit on. And I would say we're doing a lot, but there's always more to do. And, I think that's what we have to look at. So there's two broad things I would say. Number one, we need to take a look at our incumbent workers and where we can do help to upskill and reskill those to make sure that those workers can meet, have the skills that are needed that employers are looking for today. So that's one part of the equation. And the second part of the equation is, we have a sort of fundamental change in our workforce because of COVID, but also demographic changes. We look at the baby boomer generation. They're aging out of the workforce and many may not be returning. And so we have a long-term sort of paradigm shift that we have to be prepared for of potential labor shortages. And so we need to tap into underutilized pools of labor. And I'll give you just one quick example while I have a moment. Just past week, I was at Massasoit Community College with a local, looks like I'm going to have to come back to this. Hopefully we can have a follow-up.
Can we give an additional 30 seconds? Additional 30 seconds. And then if you want to...
Yeah, these are very short time frames, guys. I have a lot to say. No, very briefly, I was at Massasoit Community College with their reentry program, which is focusing on helping former inmates coming out of the House of Correction to find jobs in the diesel mechanic industry, which is an industry that needs a lot of help. Okay, number two is a good paying industry. You can get a job there making really good, starting off at $50,000 and going up very quickly. And so that's one, what I would call a win-win, where we're helping cut down on recidivism, helping these former inmates transition back into society, but also tapping into an underutilized pool of workers and helping to fill some jobs in an industry that really needs it.
Yeah, and I would just say, like I was mentioning, everything's connected from affordability to the job training. I think it's a big opportunity for us going forward. We're talking about good-paying jobs. We need to make sure that we're investing in the right type of education. The fact that a student that's qualified to go to a vocational school in Massachusetts has to go through a lottery and can't get in is a shame. We have to do better for them. We are leaving people behind that are able to go on and get good craft jobs, union jobs that are good-paying. We have to be able to invest more. No amount is enough if one student is left out of that opportunity. None.
Can I have another follow-up?
Oh, thank you.
Where do you both stand in regards to like a South Shore Vo-Tech trade schools? Do you feel that maybe the state should be going more towards investing in trade schools like a South Shore Tech, just name because it's here in the district. I'll go with Ken.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the single biggest point in our educational process that we need to be investing in. As I mentioned, it's a genuine and I think an attainable goal that every qualified student that wants to go to a technical school should be able to go to one. And some towns obviously aren't members of a VOTEC program or a VOTEC district, which is fine if they think they can meet certain minimum requirements. That's where the requirements should be. You should need to be able to offer your students, just in the way for special education, you need to meet a minimum threshold. We should be doing the exact same thing for vocational programming. We need to make sure that we massively expand facilities and teaching capabilities at VOTEC, and then we need to empower the individual school districts to get the students there or provide programming in lieu of participating in a district like that. So yes, it's one of the most important educational investments that we need, not just desire, we need to make this to create a workforce that will fill all of those jobs you're mentioning and help the local economy.
Yeah, I agree with Ken, and we're doing this already. In fact, I've worked extensively with South Shore VOTEC, Superintendent Tom Hickey. In fact, we got some good news earlier this year. We worked together to get them qualified for the school reimbursement program, which is something they've been trying to do for, I believe, 7 years or longer. So that was a nice victory. But broadly speaking, you know, there's something called the Career Technical Institute, that is an initiative that started a couple years ago, and this year we bumped up the funding for it up to $20 million. And basically what it is, it's leveraging those existing assets that exist at our VOTEC schools, as Ken rightly pointed out, and creating a second shift or even a third shift so that more people, and especially young adults, people who maybe, you know, are past the high school level, can go back and take classes to learn a trade. Because let's face it, we, you know, the average age of, you keep hearing the average age of plumbers over, you know, older than me, which is getting up there. And, you know, we need more people in the trades, and we need to sort of change the paradigm of getting away from this four-year college degree and more into skills credentialing and stackable certificates. It's something I've worked quite a bit on this term, and as chairman of the Future Work Commission, something I, you know, I'm very passionate about, and I'm out of time.
Lenny Rowe, questions.
Yes, Charles, thank you. So a question from the venerable Christine James. Does small business get enough attention in your district, and what more needs to be done? Josh?
Oh, yeah, thank you. So I would always say yes, but there's always, I will never say we're doing everything we can be doing, okay? There's always more we can be doing. I just literally this past week hosted an event for small businesses over at Tiny and Sons in Pembroke and brought together a Mass Hire South Shore, also folks on the Mass Growth Capital Corporation and Commonwealth Corporation, to basically bring down resources, because there are, you know, there's a lot of resources that are available to small businesses, and I think, unfortunately, they're not always aware of them, and we don't always do a great job of making sure they're aware, and that's something that, you know, I think us as legislators and the state needs to do a better job, is making people aware of the benefits that are out there. And so that was what we did. We had a great group of folks, small business owners, right here on the South Shore that we brought in. We did it in partnership with the Plymouth Area Chamber of Commerce and the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce. I've been, you know, a past board member of the Chamber of Commerce. I'm very active with all my local chambers. I was successful in getting funding in the budget this past year for the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce, for the Hanson Business Association. Also, we used to have a Duxbury Business Association. I've gotten some funds in an economic development bill to try to sort of revitalize that. I think the role of small businesses is vital, and I'm really dedicated to trying to help them.
Thank you. Jim? Sorry, can you just repeat the question real quick?
Of course. So does small business get enough attention in your district, and what more needs to be done?
Absolutely. I, of course, would say that small businesses is never really, you know, getting enough attention, right? I mean, one we saw, they were the ones most negatively affected during COVID, particularly hospitality. One, this issue is really personal to me, of course. My family owns and operates a small business. Like I said, my grandfather started in 1969 after returning from Vietnam. It's a great legacy, very well known in the community, very important. And, you know, we were fortunate to be deemed essential during the pandemic, but many weren't. So I think the role of government has often been, at least in recent history, to, you know, sort of tamp down the economic activity and not always assist our small businesses in the district. Big problem. We need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to assist them. If that means looking long and hard at some regulations and seeing what we can do to support them rather than put extra burden on them, that's what really needs to be done. Also serving on economic development for the town of Hanson. I've gotten to know a lot of local businesses, also working closely with the chairman of the Board of Selectmen to run Hanson over there and understand their needs, and there's a lot of needs, and I think the state can fulfill a lot of them in the future.
Okay, am I too early now, Larry?
You're right on time.
right on time. It's time for a break. You've been listening to a political forum at WATD.
Each year, about 1 out of 2 men and 1 out of 3 women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than 2 or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced cancer care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical Faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
You like my new car?
Well, I like that new car smell. What is that infernal binging?
Oh, it's part of the driver assist. Standard equipment nowadays.
Assist?
Yeah, watch.
Hey, cut that out. You're way too close.
Yeah, it's telling me that. See the text?
Watch out.
What was that?
You were driving too close. That truck snapped back a rock.
And now I have a cracked windshield?
You know, your mother was a way better driver assist.
Please, kindly check your windshield.
I'm Peter Brown from Tiny & Sons Glass. We replace your windshield and insurance pays. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call. And thank you.
Plymouth County is a large area stretching from just south of Boston down to the Cape Cod Canal. I'm Alex Bazanson. Join me and my guests for countywide coverage, everything from the Mayflower landing to the most recent town meetings, how national news affects us locally, and how things that happen in Plymouth County affect the rest of the South Shore. Tune in for All About Plymouth County tomorrow night at 7 here on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub is an upscale Irish pub with all the class of a Boston pub. The menu offers favorites like steak tips, fish and chips, meatloaf, as well as burgers, sandwiches, and pizza. The relaxed, comfortable atmosphere at McGuigan's makes it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. New hours are Tuesday through Thursday, 4 to close, Friday through Sunday, 11:30 to close. McGuigan's Pub is at 546 Washington Street in Whitman, with the full menu available at McGuigan'sPub.com.
When you think about a business you like, what sticks in your mind? They're efficient, everything looks professional, and they're timely. You don't need an entire marketing staff to have that for your business. You just need to contact We Print Today. Printing and copies are just the beginning. We Print Today offers professional engineering copies, scanning, emailing, fax service, UPS shipping, mailing services, rubber stamps, signs, banners, posters, and much more. Give your storefront a facelift with new posters from We Print Today. Reach your customers directly with We Print Today's mailing services. Promote your event with flyers, brochures, signs, and banners. Clean up your office space and take advantage of We Print Today's secure document shredding. When your business needs it done quickly and professionally, call We Print Today at 1-800-WPT-FAST or visit them online at weprinttoday.com. We Print Today, 66 Summer Street, Route 3A in Kingston. We Print Today, because tomorrow may be too late.
By the middle of the week, so much news has come your way, you need your own team to sort it out. Lucky for you, there's Jared Valenzuela and the JV team to talk about the things you've heard and catch you up on some things you might not know.
I'm Jared Valenzuela. Join me and my guests as we have fun with current events and try to put things into perspective each week. Sponsored by Corey Welch of Boom Realty. Catch the JV team every Wednesday night at 6:15 here on 95.9 WATD.
WATD's political forum continues. Now, back to Studio B. Here's your moderator, Christine James.
Well, I'm not even doing a Christine James imitation. This is Charles Matheson filling in for Christine James. Let's talk about question one. My son and his girlfriend came up from New York this weekend, and they remarked on the number of political advertising on TV. And I said, well, it's because we have all these questions. And, of course, because political ads pay the bills at TV stations. So what about question one? Josh, what is it? The actual title of question one?
Well, it's proponents call it the Fair Share Amendment. I think people commonly call it the Millionaire's Tax, but that's correct. Not the official name.
Yeah. So, Ken, what do you feel about the Millionaire's Tax?
Well, there's a couple things to talk about with this. Number one is there's a $6 billion surplus in the state right now. There's absolutely no reason to be raising any taxes at all. We have the money. We're fortunate here in the Commonwealth that some things have been run in a way that we've over-collected revenue. We're actually giving $3 billion back to the taxpayer, fortunately, because of a lesser-known law from the 80s, Chapter 62F. We're very fortunate that that money's going back to the taxpayer. So to try to reason why we would be collecting more taxes when we have a surplus, when we have the things in place, and there's going to be a lot of, you know, talking points, if you will, around this about, oh, it's for education and roads, but the legislature is able to appropriate funds. So whether they're moving certain funds, any revenue that comes in from this, if it's, say, for example, it's $1 million, they can reappropriate $1 million away from public education and roads. So there is no net gain here. This is really just taking in tax money. It's going to affect our economy. We're losing taxpayers. 50,000 people left Massachusetts last year, and we can't have that continue.
Josh, how do you respond?
So question one, right? Okay.
Question one.
All right, so question one. So question one would...
The Fair
Share Amendment. Yep, so I'm voting yes on question one.
See, the question to you goes to the Fair Share Amendment. The question to Ken went to the Millionaire's
Tax. Oh, I see. Oh, I gotcha. Okay. Well, thank you for that distinction. So the Fair Share Amendment would basically tax someone's second $1 million an additional 4%. Our current state mass income tax is a flat 5%. And so that wouldn't change at all. It would still apply to the same sources of revenue. But for someone's second million, you would start to get that extra 4% tax. The revenue for that would be designated solely for public education and transportation. And that's written into the question and maybe written into the state constitution. So that's not something that can be easily tinkered with. I think, you know, you have to kind of split what's going on today with a long-term permanent change to our tax code. I think I agree with Ken. You know, we are in good fiscal times right now because of good management and our predecessors. And actually starting tomorrow, $500,000 refund checks. Excuse me, let me clarify. Checks for... the quantity of $500,000, not $500,000, are going to start flowing out to Commonwealth taxpayers based on what they paid in state income tax last year. Its average is going to be about 14% of what someone paid. So that you have to, you know, look at that separately from what's going to be the long-term fiscal impact of this, and hopefully we can have a follow-up.
Yes, the follow-up is, why don't we just have a progressive income tax in Massachusetts as we do with federal government and a majority of states. Ken.
Sure. I mean, just start off this, I think this question is really framed wrong in the sense that why are we looking to raise taxes and increase revenue when we are giving revenue back? We have so much we can't even spend. There's federal ARPA and CARES Act money that hasn't been spent. There is money galore. We do not need to be taking money. This could drop us into, we are the fourth highest for people leaving their state, behind only California, New York, and Illinois, which contains New York City, LA, and Chicago. That's unacceptable. We want to talk about my opponent's opening statement about leading the nation in many things. We shouldn't be leading the nation in the amount of people that we are losing. We shouldn't be taking...
Sure. And restate the question. This is partially to address the fact that Massachusetts does not have a progressive income tax. We have a flat tax of 5% for everyone. Sure. So this is a step towards a progressive tax. Should Massachusetts have a progressive income tax rather than this one-time 5%, 4%?
No, especially not raising it. If you want to talk about lessening the tax burden for people, we can have a conversation about that. But no, I don't see a need for revisions when we have so much revenue.
So, Josh.
Yes, thank you. So I would say in terms of I agree with the second part of what Ken said. We are, you know, in addition to the $3 billion that's going to be refunded back to taxpayers, we are currently working on an economic development bill that has some permanent tax reductions for folks. And I think it's important. It's not just a one-time, you know, quick fix. It's some permanent changes, including a change to the estate tax to make us more competitive, the child care tax, the rental deduction tax, tax, the senior circuit breaker tax credit to raise the amount that people can qualify for. So those are some long-term permanent changes to our tax code that will help people, you know, in the middle class, Frank, and I think that's where the folks that need the tax help the most. I think people, you know, who are making, you know, facing paying 4 cents for their second million, you know, I think they can afford to pay a little bit more to fund the services and reduce the burden on the rest of us.
Is this an ineffective step toward a progressive
tax? Yeah, no, it is. I think it is. I mean, I think the reason, to answer your original question, Charles, I think there are some legal, there's been attempts in the past to have a graduated income tax in Massachusetts. I think there haven't been any during my tenure, but I think, you know, if you look back in the last 50 years, there have been a couple attempts. And I think a couple times they've been rejected by the voters. A couple times they've been challenged in court, I believe. I understand there's something constitutional in our state constitution that limits our ability to do that, which is why proponents have pursued this course, which is to put a ballot, a change to the Constitution that had to be approved by the legislature in two successive sessions and then goes before the voters for final determination. And the voters will, you know, have their say. And that's what will happen on November 8th. So it's quite a laborious process when you're changing the state Constitution, as it should be, in my opinion. And so that is, I think, a step, an attempt to have a more progressive tax code that, you know, proportionally reduces the burden on the middle class.
I notice Ken has his finger up.
My hand, whole hand, no particular finger. But the final point I'd like to make about this is we're talking about, you know, getting a little bit off question one here with the progressive income tax, because this isn't just income. Question one, you know, is going to go after what they call one-time millionaires. If you bought a house for $500,000 or $800,000, whatever it may be, you paid down on that house, and now with COVID and it's been 20 years, you have the equity and you sell that home for, say, $1 million or $2 million, that is counting. That is what's going to be taxed. If you're a small business owner that put in your time for 20, 30, 40 years, built this big business, or, you know, small by some standards, but big for the district, and you try to sell off that business, that is being included. So to say that this is about income and these are, oh, these millionaires in private jets, that's not true. That's you know, Joe the plumber types. That's, you know, someone who has a property and is selling, looking to retire. That is all what's being, I would even say, like, attacked here. That's your money that's being taken away when we have a surplus and it doesn't need to be.
Josh, what's actually in the law regarding what Ken just said?
Yeah, so I think it's important. And again, I ran a business, small business. It was an S corporation, so, you know, pass-through entity, just the types of businesses that would be affected here for 10 years. And so I understand this pretty well. I think it's important to look at the difference between revenue and profit, and also the difference between sales price and a gain. So look at the example of a house. When you sell your house, let's say you sell a house for $1.5 million, which is a pretty, you know, princely sum, but certainly plenty of houses around here that would meet that. You know, that's the sales price. That's not what you're paying your tax on. You're paying it on the gain, your capital gain. So you subtract what you bought the house for. You subtract all the capital improvements that you made over the lifetime of that home. You subtract, depending on whether you're single or jointly filing, you subtract either $250,000 or $500,000. So this idea that you're, you know, the average person's with the sale of their home is now going to be paying extra tax is just not correct. It's, you know, I call it math magical. It's not accurate. There will be certain folks who are paying, who have, you know, significant, you know, investments that have made a lot of money in their homes. Yeah, they'll pay a little bit more. But the average person is not. It's a very small number that will be subject to that. And I think it's the final note I'd say is this $1 million threshold is indexed over time. So the threshold is always going to be going up. So it's not going to ensnare middle class voters, you know, 10 or 20 years from now.
Mr. Tocci, questions for the candidates.
Let's talk transportation, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen who are listening at home. State officials have been pushing residents to use and rely on public transportation, like the MBTA, its buses, the commuter rail. But the system, let's be honest, is rife with problems. Should the state continue to finance this mode of transportation, or is it time to privatize the system? Mr. Sweezy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think investing in public transportation is certainly important, particularly where we are in the state. It's a great way to get into the city, even post-COVID. Plenty of people still go into work every day. So it's a system that needs to be invested in. It needs to be fixed. I mean, if someone can show me on paper that the state or a private entity can manage it cheaper, more efficiently, and better, then honestly, at this point, I think we need to explore all options. I'm not particularly for or against either mode, but we just had a commuter rail derailment in Hanson that blocked Main Street it's just inexcusable at this point. We have people jumping off bridges over the Charles River. Where does it end? People need to know that if we're investing in these technologies, these modes of transportation at very large costs, I might have as well, that they're going to be safe and they're going to be reliable. So I am not going to, you know, overpromote any mode of transportation at the detriment of any individual. If they want to, you know, invest in their own, you know, private car or carpooling is a great way to get in there. But we need to look at what the best way to do it is and not be married to one or the other, I think.
Same question.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. So just I need to clarify, our commuter rail is managed by Keolis, which is a private company. It is privatized today. So I don't think that's working tremendously well. Their contract runs through 2026. I think we pay them about $400 million a year to manage that. So it is a private company that's managing this. I think it's fair to question what we're getting back. And when 2026 rolls around, I think, you know, we need to scrutinize this pretty carefully and decide if this is the best solution. More broadly speaking, I mean, I get a little nervous when you're talking about privatizing public goods. I think, you know, what you compromise is critical. We're not in a race to the bottom here, okay? You know, how does a private corporation squeeze more money out? Well, they're going to cut down wages, they're going to cut corners, and I don't think that's an anyone's interest. I think, just step back, you know, I generally give Governor Baker really high marks as governor the last 8 years, and I think when it comes to transportation, you know, he could have done a little bit better. We've given him some pretty broad powers through the control board to make changes at the MBTA, and certainly some improvements have been made in terms of, you know, reducing the forecasted revenue operating deficits, getting some of the infrastructure upgraded, amount of time. But, you know, I think certainly the new administration is going to need to do more, and I think that she will.
So I would follow up and ask, is there a bidding process in order to be the private company that oversees this entity?
So they put it out. Correct. Yeah, there is, Kevin. So every, you know, when the contract runs out, you know, they're able to put it up for bid. When the contract was up, I believe it was during COVID, and so a decision was made, I believe, by the Baker administration that there was a concern, I think, that there wouldn't be a lot of bidders if they opened it up, and so they re-upped with Keolis. You know, probably a fair decision at that point. And obviously, you know, I think, to be fair, in general, the COVID has really done a number on our public transportation system, you know, from a ridership standpoint. And so, you know, building back up confidence in the system is a big part of that. But yes, to answer your question, it's a contractual basis, and will be up again in 2026. And the last point, if I could just mention, because something I'm very proud of that I did, was working in a bipartisan way with my colleagues to restore our weekend commuter rail service for Hanson, which is now back. And for many years, we were the only area of the state that didn't have that weekend commuter rail service.
So I'd give him an opportunity. So do you think that the state should do something different when it comes to the bidding in 2026 when it comes back up and around?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with that bidding process in particular. Competition is always good. I think that's an important tenet of our system. I encourage it. You know, if we have one public and one private right now, and clearly neither systems are doing well, so I don't think one could say that any particular system is operating better over the other. Leadership is a big problem, right? We talk about, you know, I think it's starting to get to the point where people have talked about reorganizing some leadership at the MBTA, and I think that's important. You know, if you're not getting the job done and you're a bureaucrat, then I think you have to look at performance, and we should be moving on from some people to make sure that it's safe and attainable for everybody to travel safely.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Charles, thank you. So a question we got to the newsroom was, what would you do or support to slow climate change and why? Start with Ken.
Yeah, so this is obviously a really, really important issue. We see things coming up, and I think it connects a lot to water and infrastructure. You see the drought that Pembroke just went through. We have to make sure that in the moment, we have to be able to combat that immediately, whether it's getting bottled water down there when they're struggling through MEMA, whatever it may be, making sure the government is there to meet them where they're at. We also need to make sure that we are doing things to protect our coastlines that are eroding and things of that nature. That all needs to be done. We need to make sure we pay attention to the seawalls in Marshfield and Duxbury. All of these things need to be addressed where they at. But if there's no holistic solutions nationally, then we cannot I will not promote any quote-unquote environmental legislation that is going to hurt individuals and businesses in this district. That is an incredibly important point. If we talk about something holistically and we're trying to adhere to national guidelines, we can have that conversation. But to have Massachusetts, this 7 million population in a 365 million population nation, that is just way out in front of these things and hurting businesses is not right. And I will be there to support businesses and then support the small needs we as they come with droughts, seawalls, et cetera.
Josh?
Yeah, same question. Thank you, Lenny. So, again, this is a big topic. So, I 100%, you know, we need to do a lot more. We've done a lot. We did a big, two big bills the past two sessions. Give a shout out to my good colleague, Rep. Moschino in Hull, who was one of the champions of the climate roadmap bill, which I was proud to support. It's a bipartisan piece of legislation signed by Governor Baker. I mentioned a little earlier, but there was a bill that we did last session, the Energy Save Act, which is something that I was the lead sponsor of. I led on that. And that was addressing and updating our appliance efficiency standards, getting back to, you know, the cheapest kind of energy is the energy you didn't use in the first place. And so when we upgrade our efficiency standards, it means we're consuming less energy. I think when it comes to seawalls, you know, I've worked with the towns of Duxbury actually to get state funding for the seawall repairs. We're continuing to do that. We have some more seawalls that we're trying to get done. That's not an answer to, you know, climate change. That's a, you know, sort of a symptom of it. But we need to have a comprehensive, a holistic view, you know, adaptation and mitigation. But it's something I don't think we can afford to, you know, we need to lead on. So that's one area I guess I disagree a little bit with my opponent.
I find candidates, because we do these on a regular basis, not just for your race. I didn't know if you knew that.
We were not the only special people?
No. Yeah. And a theme that recurs is regulation. We need to cut regulation. And I always wonder, what regulations do you want to cut? Because when I turn on the faucet in my house in Plymouth, I want clean water to come out. And when I buy some lamb, I want to know that there's that lovely blue stamp on it, that it's been inspected. So what is excessive regulation and what is not? Let's start with you, Ken.
Yeah, I think when we are overburdening small business and individuals, that's where it is. You know, we have some stuff coming up. We're talking about maybe eliminating vertical lines for lobstermen. I'm very proud to say that I've met with many, many lobstermen and fishermen in this district and even have talked to the leader of the Mass Seafood Collaborative, a great organization that brings a lot of those stakeholders together and advocates for those fishermen. They don't know what they're going to do. I mean, we've already, you know, looked so hard into this climate change and ecology stuff. Now we're worried about right whales being tangled in lines, even though no right whale has died in over 30 years having to do with lobstering. So what? This is a perfect example of we're going down this rabbit hole of over-regulating small business. And it connects to what I wanted to mention as well, not only the bills listed by my opponent, but also a big proponent of offshore wind, which the Mass Seafood Collaborative is extremely worried about. And rightfully so. We don't know exactly what this is going to do out there to the ecology. They're not even going to have the space needed to use certain equipment like net dragging and things like that. This is stuff that just can't happen. A 400-year-old industry could be destroyed and altered in an unknowing way because of these overdoing.
Josh. Regulation.
Well, so I hope we can talk about offshore wind because I'm a big proponent of that. But let me come back to the original question. I talked to a lot of small business owners. As I mentioned earlier, I just had an event with about 30 small business owners in Pembroke. And I don't hear that often. I hear, you know, we need more workers. We need more customers. That's what I hear most often. And I think that's where the focus is. I think, you know, earlier in the term, we heard a lot of issues about unemployment insurance costs. And as the chairman of that committee, it's something I worked quite hard on. We actually froze unemployment insurance costs. So keeping costs in check, I think, is certainly a fair concern. But in terms of overregulation, I haven't specifically heard that. You know, certainly we should be open to that. And if there are, you know, if any small business owner has a concern about a particular area of overregulation, I think, you know, they should come to us. And I'm certainly keeping an open mind. And I think that's an area where I probably agree with Ken. I don't agree about offshore wind, though. I think that is, you know, really a major hub of Massachusetts' clean energy future and jobs. And I think that's something we need to be aggressive about. And I'm happy to talk about the vertical buoy lines, too. I'm out of time.
All right, let's go to the lightning round. Too early?
No.
Okay. The lightning round is where we ask a question that requires a short answer. Lightning, quick. Like think of a storm. You hear the thunder, the lightning comes right away because it's.
Sometimes there's a delay though.
Yeah, sometimes there's a delay, but not now. Mr. Tarchi,
would you support an open road or mileage tax to fund transportation infrastructure? This is a yes or no question, simply put. Mr. Sweezy.
No.
So it doesn't work, Kevin. You know, policy is more complicated than that. I think if we were to get rid of the gas tax, I might consider it. But in addition to the gas tax, no.
Even with a surplus?
As I just said, if it was instead of the gas tax, I think this is important. This is not how we make policy. This shouldn't be how we make policy. We should have a thoughtful discussion about these kind of things.
Of course. I agree.
Okay, thank you.
But this is the lightning.
All right.
Lenny, do you have the news director question?
I do, yes.
Well, why don't you ask it?
So this is a question that gets asked by Christine James at every single forum. County government, stay or go? Josh?
Stay, and I also think it's time to retire that question.
Ken?
Stay.
Thank you.
Do you hate or love candy corn, Josh?
Love.
Yeah. Oh, Ken?
Hate very much.
Okay. Mr. Tarchi?
I'm in favor of candy corn, just saying. Would you be in favor of a permanent meals tax-free week for restaurants? Yes or no? Or is it too policy-driven?
John. Hey, now. maybe.
Okay.
Most likely, yes.
Lenny?
Thank you. Do you either of you have a favorite place in the district? Ken?
Favorite business would be Heidi's Hollow in Hanson.
Josh?
Favorite place would actually be, well, I guess I'm biased, I'd say the Cutler Forest.
there's controversy tonight, Halloween, about costumes. So should costumes be scary, or is that too insensitive, Josh?
I think costumes should be what people want them to be.
Yeah. Scary's in the eye of the beholder, yes.
Okay, good.
My daughter's a Care Bear tonight, so, I mean, that could be scary to someone, you know? I don't know.
It's time for closing statements. And we, as following our procedure, it's Josh first.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Kevin and team here at WATD. Thanks, Ken, for a good discussion, I thought, tonight. And thank you to the listeners for tuning in. It's been the greatest professional honor of my career to serve as our state representative. Working together, I think we've really got a lot done. I've helped secure a record level of funding for our communities, delivered resources to help our schools, seniors, public safety, and small businesses. I helped pass a major new law for mental health care access. I fought for new employee paid sick leave benefits, increased funding for career centers, and new supports for early child care workforce. Most importantly, though, my team and I have helped hundreds of our neighbors who reached out needing help. My focus is on solving problems and delivering results. I'd be honored to earn your vote again, honored before November 8th, so we can continue our work together. Thank you.
Ken Sweezy, final statement.
Yeah, I also would like to thank everyone at WATD, moderators, and my opponent as well for great discussion and honestly a great race. It's been very respectful and cordial the whole time, so thank you for that. You know, we had great discussion tonight, and I think you see very clear policy differences between my opponent and I. You see also a key philosophical difference, one where small business, individual freedoms, parental rights are always at the forefront of my mind. I can promise you that no one will be a bigger advocate for those things than me. And I think on the same theme, you know, as having a great cordial discussion and race, and honestly across the district I hear, oh, well, quote, Josh is a good guy. And I generally agree with that sentiment, I guess. But the biggest thing is, you know, we can only have, you know, so many letters that can go to your niece for her honor roll before a vote for police reform is not absolved. So many Eagle Scouts that can be attended before bad legislating on a host of issues can no longer be absolved. So I just ask you to consider all those things and ask you to vote for me before or on November 8th. Thank you.
You've been listening to a political forum for state representative candidates in the 6th Plymouth District, Duxbury, Halifax, Hanson, Pembroke, parts thereof. Audio from this forum will be up on our website, 959watd.com. We'll have selected cuts from this forum running tomorrow morning during our newscast. And, of course, make sure you vote. If you don't vote, you don't have a voice. I'm Charles Mathewson, WATD News. Good night.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 959WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.